Well, hi, everybody. This is Patricia Corey talking to you from the Azores Islands, which is right, it's somewhere in the middle of the North Atlantic Ocean. So, first of all, we are in stormy weather here. So, should the line drop for any reason, you just hang in there because my producer, Don, will get me back on and we'll work it out. These are the wonders of technology in the year 2011. I'm reporting to you from Azores, which I truly believe is Atlantis, and that's why I call it Atlantis. And so, Patricia in Atlantis for you all. So before we get started with a very relevant guest and someone I by now consider a true friend and partner in the quest to assist the cetaceans of this planet, I would like to remind you that my book is out, Before We Leave You, Messages from the Great Whales and the Dolphin Beings. And please have a read on this book and open your heart and get involved, because as Hardy and I will discuss today, there is no time more pressing than this moment for the human race to stand for the cetacean communities of our oceans and for the oceans in general, which we will discuss now. I'd like to introduce him completely, fully, with all the honors do him, there's the word, Hardy Jones. He's been on my show a couple of times. He is truly an activist in every sense for the cetaceans and for the oceans. He's been producing films about the oceans for 3 decades. He's won lots of awards, Conservation Filmmaker of the Year from Jackson Hole Wildlife Film Festival. He's won the Explorer Club Award and Lifetime Achievement Award from the International Wildlife Film Festival. He's made over 70 films about the cetaceans and the oceans, and he's an active warrior for the oceans, but he has a style, and that is, let's do it through science, let's do it through patient study of the cetacean communities and what we can do to help educate the people that are determined to destroy. So without any further ado, Hardy, welcome. Help us learn more about your good work.
Well, thank you, Patricia, for having me back. And I'm impressed that you're in the Azores. I was there in the early 1980s, just after Europe banned the import of sperm whale oil. So I went over at probably 81 or 82. They had just quit that business, and we were trying to launch a whale-watching operation to replace the whale killing, and, of course, that's exactly what happened. The so-called vigias and all the guys who go up the top of the hill and look for the whales, and then the whale hunting crews evolved into whale watching people, and I think everybody's the better for it.
That's exactly right, and I'm, of course, not, I shouldn't be surprised, but I am delighted that you had an impact on that happening here, because I have a group of people here who, by the way, hello you guys, I know you're listening, who are with me, and we are dedicated to experiencing that immense connection with the dolphins and whales out here. And the idea that just so long ago, so shortly ago in time, the vigias, as you say, were killing rather than protecting the whales is pretty remarkable. We still have the graveyards of the whales' testimony to that work. And wow, I can't believe you were out here. But last time I interviewed you, I think I was in Newfoundland, Canada. And we were talking about Greenland and the fact that they had been allowed to take, as they call it, I think it was originally 9 humpbacks. It moved to 27. And in your book, you talk about how that is now progressing further. By the way, before we go any further, I do want to announce Hardy's just come out with, I think, his first book. It's called The Voice of the Dolphins. And it's in my hand because one of the people that came out to the Azores in my last group had your book. So you'll want to read this book, Hardy Jones, The Voice of the Dolphins, and read about 30 years of warriorship for our friends out at sea.
Yeah, you know, there's an interesting part to that, to the book, which is a new use of technology combining, as you know, or as you said, I have made films since the late 1970s. And we have put out the book in print, of course, and we put it out in Kindle, but we also put it out in an enhanced ebook format, which embeds videos into the electronic book. So people who get that will be reading along, and then they'll see color pictures, and then they'll see a video button, and they click on that. And so when we talk about, let's say, Chopper, I know you know, you probably remember who Chopper is, one of the first dolphins we ever really identified. And we write about Chopper, and then bing, you can click on a button and see a picture of Chopper circling around and coming up to the camera and so forth. So I'm really excited about that new form of technology.
Yeah, well, I'd like to announce to everyone that you'll be able, after this interview, you're going to want to go to Hardy's site, which is bluevoice.org, and he offers some pretty spectacular video snips of his incredible work underwater. But hold off on that so that you don't miss a word of the interview, and we'll announce again the places you can find his book and his site at the end of the conversation. So, Hardy, you and I agreed last time that we were going to focus not on the torture and the horrors of so much that's going on out there. We want to keep this in the positive zone, especially since we are here and having the bliss of being close to the whales and dolphins. So I'd like to ask you, since let's get back to Talgi, to the positive side. We know the horrible side. And let's talk about your progress with educating the Japanese to the idea of the toxicity of the dolphin and whale meat. And I'd like you to also talk about the situation with the radiation in the ocean and how that is affecting their distaste, hopefully, for killing any more dolphins.
Well, we have just done... We've just done a series of tests on dolphin meat from Taiji directly, and the result was, not to anybody's surprise, but the result was that we found some of the pilot whale meat being sold had 20 times the amount of PCBs that are allowable, 18 times the amount of mercury that's allowable. So again, we're proving that dolphins are not food and whales are not food. But we're embarking on two new sets of tests, which one of which is on dolphin meat from Okinawa, but that dolphin meat came from Taiji. The happy news is that demand for dolphin meat is falling. And so, yes, and so of course that makes it much less profitable and much less attractive for the fishermen to go out. But this dolphin meat from Okinawa had come from Taiji as the Taiji dolphin hunters try to expand their market. So we have our hands on that, on samples of that meat sent from Taiji down to Okinawa, purchased in Okinawa, frozen and sent to a lab in mainland Japan. And so we'll have results on that. And once we get them, we're going to publish them at the IWC to let people know the levels of toxicity in that. And I think that that's going to be an effective way of strangling the market for dolphins. And we will be testing Baird's beaked whales for... They just started hunting Baird's beaked whales in the northern part of Japan. So we will be testing that as well for toxics. The radiation issue is one that's not proven out yet. There is not a lot of radiation showing up in dolphins and whales in the area of northern Japan where the radiation leaks took place. I do have a really happy story to tell you if you want me to get over onto a truly positive side.
Absolutely.
there was a group of Americans down in the Sea of Cortez, which is that body of water between the Baja Peninsula and mainland Mexico. And they came upon what they thought was a dead humpback whale. Well, they hung around the whale for a little bit, and all of a sudden it blew. And they, obviously, it was alive. And so very bravely, these guys got in the water. And they slowly started to cut away this enormous amount of fishing gear that had accumulated on this humpback whale. And the guys who did it are from an organization that is called the Great Whale Conservancy, and that's connected to Earth Island Institute. So they got in the water, they started cutting away, and this is really, really dangerous because that whale could spook, and he could, or in this case I think it was a female, one slash of the tail, and the guy would have been crushed. But the whale seemed to be able to gauge the fact that the humans who were in the water with it were on a benevolent mission, and slowly they began to cut the net from the pectoral fin. They got it off one pectoral fin, then they got it off another, and then they began to really unroll it and eventually got it off its tail. And to everyone's absolute delight, they freed that whale. And
wow.
Now that's a great story. But what came next is something that will really tell you what the potential is for the relationship between human beings and dolphins and whales. The whale moved slightly away from the boat and then breached 43 times.
Whoa!
Can you imagine that? 43 times. Now, the guys who had done the rescue said, we don't know if it was sheer joy or if it was thanks, but I believe it was both. I believe it
was. Yeah, I was going to say it was probably both.
It was joy and it was thanks. And the reason I say that is because there was another case where a humpback whale was rescued off of San Francisco by a group of divers.
I was going to bring that up.
Uh-huh.
Go ahead.
Well, they rescued this whale who was entangled in nets, and the whale then circled around. So these divers were all in the water. The whale circled around, and with its pectoral fin, the long white wing, the whale went over and touched every one of those divers.
Oh,
now, how can you draw any conclusion but the fact that that is a sentient and very conscious action on the part of one of our fellow large brain creatures of this planet? I find it any other conclusion to me would be nonsensical.
To think that we would even question it at this point in our own evolution is pretty mind-boggling, to question the incredible significance and consciousness of the cetaceans at this point is, let's just say that hopefully we're reaching a point where we, more and more human beings, are beginning to understand that perhaps they are even much higher in consciousness levels than we are.
So I just got that footage from those fellows who took it down there in the Sea of Cortez. I'm cutting what they have, 12 minutes of footage. I'm cutting it down to about 6, and we'll present that at the IWC along with 2 other films, which are an argument against allowing Greenland to continue with its hunt. They're allowed 9 humpbacks a year. And I think it's just tragic. And in addition, they're hunting illegally. They're taking whales that are not permitted to take, and they're selling the whale meat into commercial channels instead of giving it to the native peoples, to the Aboriginal Inuit people. It's being sold in supermarkets. It's being sold in restaurants. And so there's a strong argument that they should revoke that quota and disallow them to hunt humpbacks.
Yeah, well, first of all, the quota was 9, and then they immediately increased it to 27, as you recall.
Yes, and the quota is 9 per year, and they give them a permit for 3 years, which, and so the next actual vote on the renewal would be in 2012, but we want to lay the groundwork. It's possible that there is a mechanism whereby the quota could be revoked this year, but it's not terribly likely that would take place. But next year is the year where it would be voted on again. And you're out in the Azores with the sperm whales, and I've just come back from the Dominican Republic. North of Dominican Republic on the Silver Banks is where some 5,000 humpbacks breed and calve over the period between December and April. And we were in the water with humpbacks for hours on end.
You're killing me, Hunter.
Say again?
You're killing me because, as you know, I almost made it to be able to be with you on that trip.
Oh, that's right. Yes, we did. We were discussing that. Well, it's remarkable. Often when you go out to be with whales, you say, well, okay, maybe today I'll find them, maybe today I won't. I find them today, okay, that's really great, but then the next day maybe you strike out altogether. Out there in the Silver Banks, we were with them every morning and every afternoon, and it took very little time to find them. And what's going on is that we're usually finding mothers with calves and sometimes mothers with calves and an escort. So what happens is the mother sinks to the bottom and the calf can only stay under for about 4 to 5 minutes. The mother can stay under for maybe 20. So the mother's down there on the bottom and you're looking at her and she's just like a huge rock down there. And the calf will sneak out from underneath her or from between her pectorals or something like that and go up to the surface. And then that calf is tremendously curious. And the calf will come up within 10 feet of people. And when it comes up, it has to fold its pectoral back so it won't knock into people. And the whales are tremendously conscious of our position in the water and obviously conscious of our fragility. So it's just an utterly mind-blowing experience to be that close to whales. We were out for 5 days, and it was just remarkable. So it gives me new impetus to, of course, personalizes the whales, and gives new impetus to trying to stop this kill.
You said 500 humpback whales. Did I get that right?
5,000.
5,000 humpback whales, not all at once, please tell me.
Well, it's a vast area, and this is the information that was given to me by the Dominican ranger the supervisor, was that there are 5,000 at a time, and that during a season, others may pass through there. They go through the Silver Banks and then down off of Puerto Rico, through the Mona Passage, down the Caribbean islands. So he said that maybe as many as 7,000 actually pass through those waters. But it's a vast area. It's very well managed. The Dominican government gave permits to 3 boats to go down there, to go up to those waters. And it's only the tiniest little portion of the Silver Banks that the boats are allowed to anchor in. So think on the order of like 2% of the water has got boats running around in it. And the whole rest of the place is just completely devoid of any human presence. And the whales, therefore, it's fairly obvious because they have so many other places to go. The whales that are in that are approaching us and allowing us to approach them are doing it by choice, because they could be out of there in two flicks of their tail, and they're right up there with the people. Some of the movies, which I'll be putting on BlueVoice.org in the next probably 10 days, will show people just how close we get.
We've been pretty close out here too. So of course, and this year for the first time, we had a blue whale that was so close to the boat that it was almost underneath the boat, which was pretty remarkable. There is a debate, of course, and it'll never end, and that is those who believe that humans should not disturb the wild cetaceans, and others like me and you who believe that, I can't speak for you, but for me, I really, really believe that they want, like you said, they come up if they want to. And in their superior wisdom and curiosity, they most definitely exhibit a joy and curiosity about our species.
Well, as you know, I've been going out to the Bahamas to this particular school of spotted dolphins since 1978. And people have said, you know, is it a good idea to be going in the water with them? Aren't you going to disturb them, or aren't you going to drive them away from their resting areas and things like that? Well, those dolphins, they can disappear in the blink of an eye. They're just gone. Yeah. If they want to be gone. And you can't even imagine, you look at the horizon, everybody's up looking, you can't see, but they're gone. And the best example I ever knew of that one was when we had, about 8:30 one morning on glassy calm seas, we had come upon a group of spotted dolphins who were packed so tightly. It was like you had taken 12 cigars and just bunched them all together. And we looked at this formation. The first thing we thought was that we were over a whale. And then we began to say, no, it's not one whale. It's maybe 15 dolphins who were packed together like this. And as the day went on, very interesting things happened. Mothers would take their very, very young calves and put them on the bow of our boat, which was going about 2 knots on, as I said, glassy seas. So we wondered, why are the mothers pushing their little calves up towards the bow of our boat? And then we realized that the mothers were going off to do something with this big congregation of this big mass of dolphins. And we said, well, probably they're treating us as babysitters, putting the dolphins on the on the bow of the boat and thinking that a shark will not come, you know, that close to a boat, would not come up and attack them on the bow of a boat. So we were pretty awestruck by that. And when we got in the water, we swam around and we were able to see into the group, into this mass of dolphins, and you could see that there was a very, very pregnant female in there. And this pregnant female was just enveloped by her fellow pod mates.
And
we traveled with that group from roughly 8:30 in the morning until about 4:30 or 5 in the afternoon, and then they were gone. In an instant, they were gone. We didn't see a single dolphin. Couldn't even figure out how they could have done it. But getting back to the point I was making is that these dolphins are there because they want to be there. And I think that the interactions between humans and dolphins and between humans and whales, when they're done very carefully and when they're done with great respect for the cetacean, they open up a new world. They open up new possibilities, and they show us that these are exceptional creatures that have intelligence that, you know, I'm not going to argue whether it's as great or greater or slightly less or slightly more than ours, but they obviously have a profound intelligence, and that the only way for us to really experience that is to be out there among them to some degree. So I think that where it's carefully done, it's a good thing.
Yeah, I'm really glad to hear that from someone like such as you, and I've certainly dedicated the last few, as you well know, the last few years of my life to bringing this information out to people. And here in the Azores, I've had three different groups. My third group is with me now, and we go out for a swim tomorrow. Hopefully, we've got weird weather today, but we have had hundreds of common dolphins. And one thing that I saw recently was a stampede of common dolphins. I wish it was a different name, by the way. I don't like the name common. But all of the calves were in front. It was at least 150 dolphins. And all of the calves were in front. And as you know, these common dolphins are small compared to some of the other species. And it was like they were racing off to school. There were at least 30 or 40 little calves. Do you have any idea from your studies of dolphin behavior what that might possibly have meant? Were they learning to hunt, do you think?
I don't know. I've seen common dolphins off of Monterey, California, in shoals of 100, 100, 200, and they just, the whole group of them is heading someplace, and they're heading fast, but I don't know why they're going there or what they expect to find, because we, excuse me, in some cases you will see that a school of dolphins will rush off to some spot, and then you can see they found food, and they're, you know, their tails are flying, and they're diving in, and they're munching away, and they clearly had gotten the word that there was a school of something somewhere, and they were moving towards it. But exactly. In the case of these common dolphins, I've seen them just cover vast areas of the Monterey Bay, and with no particular, nothing that I could detect as a destination.
They're fast. They're such fast-moving dolphins. It's incredible.
Yes, they are. Are you in Pico or Fayal or
We're operating out of Pico.
Yeah.
So it looks like every time I go to someplace on the world where there are whales and dolphins, I'm going to call you and interview you.
Well, that would be just fine, and it won't be long before I could probably talk back from the Bahama Banks or from Silver Shoals and off Dominican Republic.
Well, if this year your invitation is still open to me, I will be with you, because it is really my dream now to get in the water with the whales.
Well, we'll see if we're going to put one on again. I'm not sure whether we're going to go back out there again this year or not. But
you will, Hardy.
Make up our minds. It certainly was, and the boat was absolutely. It was like being on a yacht. It was just such an exceptional. It's called the Sundancer 2, and it's captained by a guy named Gene Flipsy. And Gene was my captain out in the Bahamas. I chartered the boat that he was captaining for many times during the 1990s and early 2000s. So Gene is a terrific captain, and the Sundancer 2 is, you know, I've been on so many kind of boats where there's not enough room for two people to stand up in the stateroom, and there's kind of smoke blowing into the ventilating system. And
yeah, no, that's not for me.
Yeah. I've gotten tired of it. It was okay for a long time. But the problem is, when you get on a boat like the Sundancer, it's real hard to turn around and go back. This one was, it has the bathroom en suite, and it has a beautiful upstairs living room, three decks, and just a lovely situation with one of the truly most capable group leaders that you'll ever find.
Well, I know that anyone who's traveled with me is saying to him or herself, that sounds like Pat Corey style.
That's right.
Listen, Hardy, Let's get back to you've been sending me some important emails, and you've been calling for help for a couple of different campaigns. And I've been trying to rally the troops, and you're always in my list of names of organizations that need support financially. So can you give us a clue on the Greenland campaign and your the $3,000 match campaign that you sent me recently?
Yes, I can. And I have to be, we're at $2,600 out of the $3,000 match. So this very good, long associate of Blue Voice and a very good friend and a true ocean campaigner herself put up the $3,000 and said, you know, whatever part of this you can match, I will put in whatever amount you can raise, I will put another dollar for dollar to it. So we've raised $2,600, which means that she's going to, at this point, put in $2,600. And I believe that with some generosity and goodwill on the part of a few other people, we'll get to the $3,000 and be able to match it. So all people have to do is go to the bluevoice.org website and click on the donate button, and then it's very easy to contribute through PayPal or through a credit card in that manner.
Well, you can count on me to add to that amount by the end of the, maybe not today, but by the end of tomorrow. But tell me what you're doing with these funds.
Okay. One of the things that we're doing with it is conducting these tests that I previously mentioned in Japan. And the tests, a battery of tests on just two dolphins, costs over $3,000. So it's an expensive proposition, but I think it's the most effective way now for us to bring an end to this dolphin hunting. There was, I'm sure most of your audience is familiar with the Cove, which gave more exposure to that issue than anything you can imagine. I mean, it was in movie theaters. It was on. It's been on television. It won Academy Awards. It won every film festival it was in.
Yeah.
And yet, it has not stopped the slaughter. What is going to stop the dolphin slaughter is when people simply stop buying it, but buying dolphin meat. And what we do is we test the dolphins, the dolphin meat, for these contaminants, and then we publish in Japanese the report, and we issue it to people in the area, to newspapers and other media, but also with flyers to people in the areas where they eat the dolphin meat, and the demand for it has fallen considerably. So that's, to me, the clear path to the end of this terrible business.
Let me interject a question, and that is, you've done these tests before. What's different now? Why do you feel that the additional tests are going to make a greater effect?
Well, one thing we're doing is testing to get a baseline. We just did a set of tests about a month ago to get a baseline. And we'll keep checking against that to see if any of the contamination, not radiation, but other contaminants, that when this great tsunami came onto the land and it then washed back into the water and brought just all sorts of junk and chemicals and things that will get into the food chain. So we will test that again to see if there's an increase in due to that, because that's going to, that takes time to evolve. But the other thing that's different is what I described as getting the meat from Okinawa and testing that, and then getting the information back to the Okinawans and letting them know that this dolphin meat that they're trying, you know, they're, it's being suggested that they eat is not healthy for them. So that's why we're doing that. And then we're also going to be testing Baird's beaked whales. Japan just opened its season on the beaked whales in the Northern Islands, and we're going to test them for with the same intention, that if we can show that the whale meat is high in mercury or high in PCBs and that kind of thing, that the whale meat shouldn't be eaten. And the consumption of whale meat in Japan has plummeted. They have 6,000 tons of it in the freezers. They don't know what to do with it, but they continue to hunt. So
that just frustrates me so much that I can barely continue the interview. I mean, really.
Well,
how many tons are in refrigerators?
6,000 tons. Each ton is obviously 2,000 pounds. So there's a massive amount of whale meat that's just sitting in freezers. And
that's more than I can bear, Hardy.
I'm sorry, say again.
It's more than I can bear. What about Captain Mike? We heard that the Japanese fleet turned away and went back to port. What's the story on that?
The Sea Shepherds?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Sea Shepherd, the program Whale Wars, which documents this, is on the Discovery Channel every Friday night. And it was for several years, I think it's in the order of four or five, Paul Watson has been bringing people down, bringing his ships down to the Antarctic and interfering with the hunt. And last year, much to my surprise, I must admit, they actually drove the Japanese fleet out of the Antarctic and stopped their whaling operations in the Antarctic.
I know. It was such an amazing day when that email circulated.
Yes, it really was. I just can't say too much about the courage of Paul Watson and the people who go down there.
Yes,
it's very, very dangerous and very difficult conditions in the Antarctic. And I respect him for his courage and for standing up on this, but also for the ability he has of the logistical ability of mounting getting three and four boats down there and supplying them and having gasoline and helicopters and just an incredibly effective guy and group. And they're now in the Mediterranean trying to protect the bluefin tuna from extinction.
Exactly. And they're also going to be trying to stop the slaughter at the Faroe Islands. What do you have to say about that?
Well, we thought that the Faroe Islands were finished with that hunting, because about four years ago, the first report came out from the Faroese and Danish medical authorities, and it said there are these high levels of toxins in the pilot whales that you're killing and eating. And okay, that came out, nothing happened. But then the next year they came out and they said, you shouldn't eat this stuff. Hello? We told you last year that it was poisonous. We thought maybe you just sort of get it from that. But now we're telling you, don't eat it. It is bad for your health. And they've done studies on these Faroese people and found that, in fact, they do have learning retardation and other symptoms of mercury poisoning. So
excuse me for interjecting this, but could we say that they are mentally deficient and that's why they are doing the slaughter of these innocent animals?
I wouldn't be surprised. It's an utterly barbaric thing that they're doing, and it's unfortunately Denmark can't do anything about it. The Faroes and Greenland are very autonomous from Denmark. So Denmark actually ends up being a sort of umbrella country for the Faroes and Greenland in the international organizations like the IWC.
But Captain Paul, when I had him on, told me that every Faroese citizen gets a 3,000 euro stipend a month from the EEC. Do you concur with that?
You mean, do I believe that that's true?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. It is true. They get it from, I thought that they got it from Denmark, but they, not only the Faroese, but the Greenlanders. Now, Greenland, one of the, there's some very odd things going on in the world these days, as I'm sure we are all noticing, but the melting of the ice in the area of Greenland has opened up petroleum resources. And this little country of Greenland is about to become one of the next mega oil nations. So it's a population of only a few hundred thousand people, and they're going to have all of these oil resources. What I think is ironic is that they're going to be bringing out more oil, which is going to, when consumed, will increase the amount of greenhouse gases in the air, and so things will get warmer, and, you know, it's this kind of vicious cycle.
Right, but they're still going to be killing whales, or do you think that we can knock some sense into these aboriginals?
Well, I think that the aboriginals are, it's a tricky case. They're people who are trying to maintain a culture, maintain their traditional culture in a world that's evolving out from underneath them. And it's not the aboriginals are not the ones I have the problem with. It's the guys who are ordering the whale meat, the guys who are bringing it into the European side of the equation, selling it to tourist hotels, selling it to markets. Where I was doing some, you know, undercover filming with my iPhone, and just. That's such a great tool, just because people, it looked like I was talking on the phone, but in fact, I was standing right in front of the meat market, and I could see the people who were coming in to buy the whale meat, and it was Europeans.
And so, the excuse is that the excuse for granting Greenland the permit is because it's a tradition of the aboriginals, but the reality is not that at all. So, let's hope that at the next IWC meeting, which, by the way, for you, those of you who don't know, that refers to the International Whaling Commission organization, that hopefully this is going to come up. And I have a feeling you're going to bring it up, right, Hardy?
Yeah, we'll be bringing it up. We're registered as NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and so we'll hold a press conference. We're producing a film in collaboration with WDCS, the Whale and Dolphin Conservation Society in the UK, and we're producing a fact sheet. I'm putting together what's turning out for me to be a fascinating little project of getting all of the information about cetacean intelligence, particularly humpback intelligence, into a paper and distribute that with the idea that we're bringing into this organization the idea that whales are sentient creatures on a par with humans, and they should not be killed for that reason. The scientific people will come in and they'll say, well, you know, if there's enough of a population of whales, you can take them. But we don't think you should be taking humpback whales any more than you should say, well, this place is overpopulated with people, so go ahead and, you know, take 30% of them. That's one of the things Blue Voice does in these meetings is we add to the scientific data by putting a moral and ethical argument forward that these humpback whales, you just shouldn't kill them, period.
Exactly. Well, you do a wonderful job of merging the, as you say, the moral, spiritual aspect of this with your work as a scientist too, so that I'm sure that you get into places where, for example, I wouldn't, because they would dismiss me as being too much of a woo-woo character. But you're doing a great job out there, Hardy. You're one of my heroes.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So for all the people that are listening, and that includes my group here, I've asked them at the end of this week that we should contribute to one of the organizations out there that's doing good work for the cetaceans as a step, because many people ask me, like when they read the book, okay, I'm completely committed, but I don't know what to do. And I say, get out there, If you can't physically do any activity like cleaning up the oceans or being on board the Sea Shepherds, help the warriors who are out there fighting for the rights of the cetaceans. So here we have an opportunity. You are a non-governmental, independent organization. You have a high level of morality, and yet you work scientifically to be able to deal with those guys. And you're humble, and you're asking for so little. So to all the people that are listening, can we not only find that additional $260 for Dear Hardy and his team at Blue Voice, but let's do even better than that so that he has a jump start on his next campaign. And please, please, please understand how important it is that there are warriors out there doing what you think you want to do, but you simply can't manage to do for whatever reasons in your life. You can't personally get out into the oceans and make a difference. And donate to my friend and my fellow cetacean warrior, Hardy Jones. His website is bluevoice.org. As he said, there's a donate button there. Love that, Hardy.
Yes, well, that's the lifeblood of these campaigns is the individual contributions. And you know, we'll leave the IWC. We'll be there from the 7th to the 15th of July, and then in August we'll be up in Greenland trying to document further the abuse of this quota that's been given by the IWC to Greenland, which is solely for the Aboriginal peoples, solely for them to hunt and solely for them to consume.
Supposedly.
That's not the way it's going. So that's where our funding goes. It's to investigations like that and to getting tests done of cetaceans to prove that, you know, that they shouldn't be eaten. But of course, I'm sure the irony of that doesn't escape anyone, that the argument to save dolphins that we're using in Japan is that the oceans are so toxic and the dolphins have consumed so much toxicity in the marine food chain. That's a terrible thing to have to argue for the salvation of these animals. It's a terrible sign of what is going on in the oceans, that they accumulate, because we are, as humans, top predators as well. Now, we don't eat as much fish as dolphins do, of course, but I don't know if your audience is aware of the fact that I personally was diagnosed with mercury poisoning in 1997. I, at that time, was eating a lot of fish, virtually every night, and I was eating swordfish and tuna, which I now sorely regret, but I ended up just getting terribly fatigued and going to a doctor, going to many doctors, none of whom could diagnose what I had. Then I walked into the office of a chiropractor, and first guy I'd been to who listened to me. He listened to my description of what my symptoms were, and he said, "Oh, wait a minute." And he did one of these little muscle tests that some people may be familiar with. He said, "Oh, you've got this ileocecal valve syndrome, and let's test you for mercury." So he took some snips of my hair, and he sent the hair off, and it came back. And lo and behold, my mercury levels were literally off the chart.
Yikes.
And I stopped eating the fish. 6 months later, my level had been cut by more than half, and today I am below I have less than the safe amount in me, less than one part per million.
Well, that is important information. It also helps me for my campaign for vegetarianism, and it will definitely affect what people eat for dinner tonight at the restaurant. Thanks for that. Party hour. Our time is up once again. It's flown by, as it always does with you. And all I can say is I love you. I'm so proud of the work you do. And I will do everything I can to rally the troops to get that donation button clicking and to tell people about your beautiful new book, The Voice of the Dolphins. And bluevoice.org is the place to contact Hardy Jones. Thanks, Hardy. You're always there.
Thank you, Patricia.
When we're out swimming with the dolphins, and we'll carry your spirit into the blue sea with us.
Please do. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Hardy. Take good care, and we're with you. We would definitely, you'll see a click on that button tomorrow.
Terrific. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take good care.
Bye now.
All right, everybody. That's it. We will keep you. I'll keep sending you the posting pictures, sending you information. Please, please, please give a hand to Hardy. Let's get that money in there so he can go up to Greenland and when he goes to the Whaling Commission, present his case so that, for God's sakes, man, they stop killing humpback whales. 2011 we're in, and we still have sanctioned whale killing. It drives me crazy, and you know how I am when I get crazy. This is Patricia Corey talking to you from beyond the matrix, where I dare you, I implore you to think outside the box of convention and soar with the eagles. And I'll be back with you 2 weeks from now, still in the Azores, where I am hanging out, because I know it's Atlantis and I have lived here before. Love you all. Nanu, nanu. I'm signing out.